I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, how the crisis on Wall Street is reaching colleges and charities for kids, and it's not just because philanthropy is drying up. But first, an historic and heavily revised bailout bill has just passed the House of Representatives, a bill that has more oversight, insurance protection for bank deposits, more tax breaks than the one that was rejected by House members on Monday. Busy day in Congress. Gail Chadwick, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, has been following it. And Gail, give us a sense of the debate. I mean, those that changed their votes, obviously people had to. What were they saying?
They were saying that they were hearing from a very different constituency this week than last. Last week it was mainly angry voters concerned that the taxpayers were being asked to bail out Gordon Gekko and his friends, high flyers on Wall Street. This week, especially in the last couple of days, members were hearing more from car dealerships, from small town mayors. In one of the most dramatic bits of debate, Zoe Lofgren, a representative from California, read a letter from the governor, referred to conversations with the treasurer, saying that the state of California couldn't get money for a bond issue. Mm-hmm. And so it really, Main Street became dead center in these last few hours, not Wall Street. That's, I think, what turned the tide.
Well, let's listen to Tennessee Republican Zach Womp. He changed his vote from no to yes. He said his vote today would be a red, white, and blue collar vote to help Main Street.
I don't like this at all. As a matter of fact, I hate it. It's disgusting that we would ever be brought to this floor to have to cast this vote. But we're out of options. We don't have a month to rewrite a new bill. Things are critical. We don't even have gas at the stations in East Tennessee.
Gail, this is coming, the bill passing, even as we're reading in the financial pages of the New York Times, Floyd Norris writing that exactly the wrong things were added, the extra insurance in banks and the changing of the accounting that will once again make Wall Street look healthier than it actually is. So were there dissenters?
Oh, of course. And this is going to be debated forever. I think one of the most striking debates in terms of dueling economists we'll hear in a very long time. Brad Sherman of California, a Democrat dissenter, said, look, this is a pork bill. It's protecting bows and arrows, rum and wool. We're buying toxic assets now in the safe of London, Riyadh, and Beijing. You know, voted no emphatically. But the point that a number of people, in fact, virtually all the yes votes made, is regardless how we got here, regardless who is to blame, we are now in a panic and something must be done to reverse it. If the House does nothing today, if Congress goes home for 3 months doing nothing, it's just going to get worse. And so I think there was that sense that a bad bill is much better than no bill at this point.
In fact, staying with Congressman Sherman, he said that's exactly what happened. A panic was created to stampede us to do this. We also understand Texas Congressman Jeb Hensarling said that this was out-and-out socialism, but Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank had a response.
It was one of the classic moments on the House floor. Jeb Hensarling heads up the Republican Study Committee, which is the most important element of the Republican caucus, conservatives, and he said, if we lose our ability to fail, will we not soon lose our ability to succeed? We're losing our liberty here. I don't want to live in a world where my children don't have liberty. Barney Frank, chairman of the Banking Committee, stood up in a very deadpan way, said, ever mindful of the danger that George Bush will lead us down the road to socialism, we will be monitoring this very closely.
So there was a laugh. Well, President Bush says he's going to quickly sign the $700 billion federal bailout bill, again, just passed just moments ago or minutes ago by Congress. He's going to sign it into law. So what happens now, briefly?
Well, you see, immediately on the administrative side, setting up these auctions to identify a price level for toxic assets and try to suck them out of the system and hope it does some good. On the congressional side, you see chairman as early as next week beginning oversight hearings asking how did we get to this point and how do we prevent it from happening again. The how do we get to this point is designed for campaigns. We're just weeks away from a national election. The answer to that question will be the Republicans got us to this point. Don't vote for them again. But the bigger picture is what they do when they come back in January with, they hope, a Democrat in the White House and larger majorities in the House and Senate. And at that point, Barney Frank just said after this vote, we expect to redo the whole regulatory framework of finance.
Well, and at the first oversight hearing on the collapse of Lehman Brothers, we understand, is scheduled for Monday. Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, perhaps another incentive. More bad economic news today. The Labor Department reports employers slashed payroll by 159,000 last month. That's the biggest job cut in 5 years. And California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says his state, his whole state, needs a federal loan of $7 billion just to stay afloat. Well, Gretchen Morgenson is financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times. She joins us just for some perspective. And Gretchen, what do you think is happening in this moment? For instance, that plea from California for a federal bailout, is that a sign of responsibility, you know, people living in reality, or further evidence of, you know, heading off a financial cliff?
What I think it is very good evidence that the credit markets are still frozen. And particularly the most important aspect of the credit markets, which is the short-term debt market. As you know, companies, municipalities, cities, everyone needs to borrow to meet their short-term expenses, whether it's payroll, that kind of thing, teachers, employees, secretaries. And if you can't get access to those markets, then really everything starts to shut down. And so that is what we are seeing here.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't know that. We discovered, we did a story on a man whose business it is to open franchises. And he relies on, you know, what's called a revolver, a sort of a revolving loan every month. He borrows money, then pays it back. And some people misunderstood that it was just because his business is about expanding, that that's why he needed that money. But, you remind us that just to make payroll every month, a lot of companies need a revolving loan.
Absolutely. And what they do is they go into the market for a very short period of time. They say, okay, I'll pay this back within a week, within a month. Now those markets are frozen. Banks are unwilling to lend. They're afraid they're not going to be paid back. And so it sort of feeds on itself and becomes this awful downward spiral.
Well, and Gretchen, we also know that part of this whole problem is that millions of mortgages had variable interest rates that then shot up through the roof, kicked the bottom out of the housing market. People couldn't pay their mortgage. But now we're reading about nonprofits getting hit with huge increases in variable interest rates on billions of dollars of bonds they bought. They took them out like a loan to finance buildings. The Home for Little Wanderers here in Boston serves abused and neglected children. If the bond interest rates stay where they are, that group is going to have to come up with another $180,000. Their bond rate has shot up an extra $12,000 a day, this interest rate they have to pay. How is a bond and the interest rate you pay on that connected to this whole crisis?
Well, it's all about supply and demand, Robin, as most things are. And if there is a lot of supply of money, i.e., if there are a lot of investors out there who are willing to lend money to you, me, and other businesses, then the cost of that capital is lower. If there are fewer people willing to lend, the cost of that capital goes up. So here we are in a situation where banks are really, really withdrawing from the market, being unwilling to lend, and so the cost of capital is way up, and it's affecting everyone. As you point out, it's affecting municipalities, it's affecting the charitable organizations, it's affecting colleges. I don't know if you've seen those stories about how they can't access their funds and to make their own payroll.
Well, in fact, Boston University, which we think was one of the first schools to make such an announcement and is where we are based, announced a hiring freeze and a halt to any new construction. And we understand schools are worried they're going to have to raise tuition, and they're definitely going to have problems with loans.
Yes. So it is everywhere, and we are really in a very, very difficult spot here.
Well, your colleague, Stephen Labaton, today in The Times, described a Securities and Exchange Commission decision in 2004 to lift the limit on the amount of debt that investment companies could take on. Now, the SEC was lobbied to lift that limit by companies like Goldman Sachs, which was led at the time by Henry Paulson, who's now Treasury Secretary. We know that this huge debt that these companies have now is a part of the problem. How do you picture a new Wall Street? Will they be allowed this huge debt? Will companies be allowed to lobby?
I think for quite a while in the future, we are going to have a real reluctance to allow people to take on the kinds of leverage or debt, as you say. We had investment banks such as Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, that had leverage of 30 to 1, meaning for every dollar that they had in assets, they had borrowed, you know, $30. So that is an amazing amount of borrowing. And I think in the future, Wall Street is going to be a lot less cavalier with money and a lot less cavalier with borrowing. And, you know, the fact is that that's going to translate to lower profits.
Well, and how else do you see that happening? I mean, we've talked about regulation, but, for instance, Paul Krugman, The Economist, says there should be even more government ownership of the financial system so that there's more oversight. What else do you see?
Well, there definitely is going to be more oversight. People are extremely irate and angry that the American taxpayer is going to have to pay for the excesses of the business people who, really, many of them walked away with millions and millions of dollars in what are probably ill-gotten gains from either bad business practices or questionable practices. And I think that people are going to just finally put their foot down and say, let's stop these things from happening so that they get out of control, so that they then have to be bailed out by the taxpayer. I mean, it's a terrible circumstance.
But how do you see, you know, how do you see that being regulated? Do you see there being caps on salaries? And how do you see that happening?
It's not about caps on salaries. It's about making sure that the kinds of practices, the lending practices that we now see as been extremely reckless during the mortgage mania, you know, how about reining those in before they become so big a problem that we have to have a $700 billion bailout? There were rules in place that the regulators could have clamped down on some of these reckless mortgage brokers and lenders, but they did not.
Do you see a time when, you know, I constantly refer to him, I'm not the only one, but, you know, as in It's a Wonderful Life and Jimmy Stewart has the bank and he holds all the mortgages. Do you see a time when mortgages won't be allowed to be securitized and sold?
Yeah. I think securitization is, going to be under a lot of scrutiny, and I think that we're going to go back to a period where a bank makes a loan to someone and they keep the loan for the longer period of time instead of this slicing and dicing mechanism that just adds to complexity, and of course it added to the profits for Wall Street.
I wonder about banks themselves. I mean, right now banks are absorbing other banks to keep them from collapsing, but we read in the Boston Globe that the big three banks now, and they write Bank of America, Citigroup, and J.P. Morgan Chase, control nearly $8 trillion in assets, banking operations that oversee roughly 30 cents of every deposit dollar in the U.S. They write, you have to go back to the late 19th century when J.P. Morgan was essentially the central bank of the U.S. These banks are scurrying now to absorb and save each other, but do you see them being broken up?
It's almost certain that, you know, as these banks really become huge, then there will be either smaller banks that will enter the competition or there will be some effort to kind of maybe split them up.
Gretchen Morgenson, financial reporter and columnist for The New York Times, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, coming up next week, what is the future of banking, even as a possible takeover of Wachovia is in the news today? We'll also check in on the presidential candidate's health plans. How much is the fiscal crisis going to impact those plans? Also in the days ahead, jazz icon Keith Jarrett on the 25th anniversary of his trio with Jack DeJohnette and Gary Peacock. Can't wait for that. Just ahead today, was it a draw, last night's presidential debate? And those New Yorker magazine cartoons, how dare they laugh while others suffer on Wall Street? Well, quite easily, as it turns out, as you'll hear. Back in a minute, here and now. No gaffes, no game changer. That's the word today on last night's vice presidential debate. Over the course of 90 minutes, Senator Joe Biden and Alaska Governor Sarah Palin sparred on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, tax cuts for the middle class, nuclear proliferation, and Iran, the Bush administration's policy on Israel, whether global warming was man-made. And the debate had its personal moments. Here's Governor Sarah Palin.
Being a mom, being one who is very concerned about a son in the war, about a special needs child, about kids heading off to college, how are we going to pay those tuition bills, about times in Todd and in our marriage in our past where we didn't have health insurance, and we know what other Americans are going through as they sit around the kitchen table and try to figure out how are they going to pay out of pocket for health care.
That drew this response from Joe Biden, who choked up, referring to the time when he nursed his surviving son after his first wife and a daughter were killed in a car accident.
But the notion that somehow, because I'm a man, I don't know what it's like to raise two kids alone. I don't know what it's like to have a child you're not sure is going to make it. I understand, as well as with all due respect to governor or anybody else, what it's like for those people sitting around that kitchen table. And guess what? They're looking for help. They're looking for help. They're not looking for more of the same.
By the way, both candidates have sons heading to the war in Iraq, and both candidates appear to have exceeded expectations. A poll by CNN and Opinion Poll Research Corporation found that 84% of those polled said Palin did better than expected, and 64% said the same of Biden. More than half of those polled thought Senator Joe Biden won, to 36% who said Governor Sarah Palin did. But did Biden really win, though? Because 54% of respondents found Palin more likable to Biden's 36%, a flip there. Liz Halloran is senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. She joins us now. And Liz, to those statistics first, because what do you make of that? I mean, the numbers almost completely flip. More respondents thought that Biden won the debate, but the same number, more respondents, liked Palin.
It's interesting. I think if you go by a traditional debate standards, Joe Biden did win that debate. But Sarah Palin came out as the Sarah Palin that we all saw in St. Paul, the sort of confident, folksy, family-oriented mom and governor of Alaska. And she gave a very credible performance last night. There was some filibustering and some avoidance of questions, but it was confident. And the McCain camp is very happy about the headlines that they're getting off of the debate this morning.
Is it safe to say that the people that wanted to like her now do, but maybe people who probably won't, for whatever reason, weren't swayed?
I think what a lot of people saw last night is it was really their first long look at Sarah Palin. A lot of people have seen the clips from those rather embarrassing Katie Couric interviews that she's had over the last, that have been aired over the last week. They've maybe seen more of a caricature of her. And so I think the people who want to like her were reassured, that the conservative base, who they love her. I've been out in Pennsylvania and Virginia recently, and they were reassured by the person that they saw. This is the person that they thought she was when they first saw her at the convention.
Well, yesterday we talked about the conservative columnist who had been calling for Palin to step down or saying she was unqualified. Did last night silence them, do you think?
I think it probably did. She is, like I said, she's very popular with the base. She's going to be effective, I think, in get-out-the-vote efforts. It's unclear whether she's going to be able to help John McCain sway any of these very important independent votes. But as you know, you want those independents to break your way, but you have to get the base out in the states that the Senator McCain is now concentrating on. You know, he pulled out of Michigan. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, let's ask you about that, because a conservative columnist, Peggy Noonan, who wasn't one of the voices calling for Palin to step down, wrote in the Wall Street Journal today that Sarah Palin saved John McCain again. She's the political equivalent of cardiac battles. The Fox News headline reads, Palin performance boosts McCain. But as you were saying yesterday, kind of went under the radar, but the McCain campaign pulled staff and TV ads in the battleground state of Michigan. Does this mean that the McCain camp might feel confident to move some resources back there, or are they really hunkering down?
I don't think that this last night's debate is going to change the McCain campaign strategy in Michigan. And I think, you know, Peggy Noonan is overstating it a bit. I do think that if Senator McCain gets her out in these really, really tough states like Colorado, Indiana, Virginia, Pennsylvania, some of these states he has to win, and they still are extremely close. Sarah Palin, as you know, draws enormous crowds, and they need to get those people motivated to get to the polls, because he needs that base. He's got to work on the rest of it. But I don't think that Peggy Noonan or the folks who are saying that this is going to dramatically shift the trajectory of the campaign are quite correct at this point.
Well, the Christian Science Monitor headline reads, Palin rebounds, but is it too late? Well, what about Joe Biden? He had a lot to overcome as well, a fear that he was long-winded, prone to gaffes. Your assessment of how he did?
Senator Biden is often, as you know, a little bit too garrulous. He's a very talkative fellow, and there was some concern that he would step on his own lines, and that the delicate balance that has to be struck when you are debating a Sarah Palin or a woman in this race. I think he struck it well. He He kept his comments directed at Gwen Ifill, who was moderating the debate. He worked very hard to tie John McCain to the George Bush administration, and he hit McCain pretty hard on health care and on the war. And so he focused on Senator McCain, and he focused on Barack Obama's policies, and he focused on Gwen Ifill, and did not get caught up in that minefield that could have existed if he engaged Governor Palin directly.
Well, and perhaps one of the most important questions outside of, you know, who do you like best, on the question of the candidate's qualifications to assume the presidency, 87% after last night said Biden is the more qualified, 42% said Palin is qualified. So that's perhaps a number also that the campaigns will be looking at. Liz, the candidates out today, is this really the... We say this all the time, but in the seconds we have, is this really the start of the campaign? Everyone's in place. No one seems to be leaving the campaigns.
I think that for the McCain campaign getting beyond last night and that vice presidential debate and sort of settling the whole Sarah Palin issue down, it's a new start for them. Senator McCain is out in Colorado today. Barack Obama's in Pennsylvania. That tells you, you know, what states are important. And I'm sure Sarah Palin, who's in Texas today raising money, will be dispatched to those very important states soon.
Liz Halloran, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, as we look ahead. Liz, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be back after the news with The New Yorker's cartoon editor, Here and Now. Wall Street is sinking, dragging down America, so let the jokes begin.
Top 10 signs your bank is in trouble. Here we go, number 10. Asked to withdraw $100 and they Xerox 520s. Uh-oh. Number 9, once a week bank president is led away in handcuffs. Number 8, 4 out of 5 bank tellers are kiddies. What? Number 7 was
David Letterman, of course. Jay Leno says it's so bad that Wall Street investors are now clinging to their guns and religion. There's Banksy, the secretive British street artist. He's been drawing huge rats on buildings in Manhattan as if to say sinking ship or rats of Wall Street. And my favorite is the email with the subject line. Have you gotten it? Your urgent assistance required. Instead of being from an African prince, it's from Henry Paulson, Minister of Treasury of the Republic of America, seeking an emergency transfer of $700 billion in funds. Just send him your bank account, IRA, college fund. It's 100% safe. Well, when the going gets tough, the tough in New York turn to the New Yorker magazine cartoons. In this week's edition of the magazine, it's never explicitly pointed out, but every single cartoon is somehow connected to the crisis on Wall Street. With us is Bob Mankoff, cartoon editor for the New Yorker, and a cartoonist himself, editor of the Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker and the New Yorker Caption Contest book. So, Bob, coincidence, or was everyone told, quick, find something funny in this?
The first I've heard of it. You're telling me all the you're right. You found us out. We are usually very explicit in our writing, but we try to be a little bit oblique in the humor. So we didn't emblazon it on the front cover. Now, complete, all financial cartoons in this issue. But they are there, yeah.
Oh, let's describe some of them. There's my personal favorite, the tired commuter, his tie loosened. He's got a 5 o'clock shadow and a briefcase. Walking in the door to his house, he shouts, "Honey, we're homeless." A man opens a door. It's a standard New Yorker cartoon. There's his wife with another man in bed, and the caption reads, "Not on the mattress where we keep all our money." What's a personal favorite of yours?
I think all of those are great. They really like the William Hamilton cartoon that shows the fat cat saying, "God damn it, Kimball, for us, Main Street is Wall Street." Also, a cartoon that relates particularly to me in a sort of reverse way is I did a cartoon in the issue where it says, "A banker, eh? Can you make a living at that?"
That's right. It's a woman at a cocktail party asking.
Yeah, because as a cartoonist, you are always asked, "Cartoonist, can you make a living at that?" So it's sort of a Schadenfreude feeling. You know, thinking of mattresses, I have my own advice, which I'm really advising most of my clients, which are none, to diversify among their mattresses.
Among their many mattresses. Well, let's go back to the one where, you know, again, it's a typical New Yorker depiction of sort of the wooden paneled men's club smoking pipes, maybe sitting
right,
in leather chairs,
right,
having a poker match, sitting around the table. And they're the ones who say, "Darn it, Kimball, for us, Main Street is Wall Street." Tell me what you think that meaning is.
Well, I mean, I think the meaning is the one of perspective, of course, that here actually in New York City, in terms of the crisis and why Bloomberg wants to continue as mayor.
This is Mayor Bloomberg, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, our Wall Street is the main street of New York,
right?
City of the financial district. I do think that the cartoons are more than comic relief. I think they actually give you really an insight into essentially the fraudulence of what's going on. I sort of think of humor in our cartoons especially as sort of a rough and ready BS detector. You know, I'm thinking of a cartoon I did a while ago in which there's a guy on the phone, he's saying, a billion is a thousand million. Why wasn't I informed of this? You know, and when I, and everyone is sort of saying it's so complicated, it doesn't seem that complicated to me. And interesting, I went up because I wanted to do cartoons. Whenever you hear a crazy phrase like credit default swap, so I wanted to make sure I knew what it was. I'm still not sure I know what it is, but I went up there and I looked at credit default swaps, and right there on the right is an advertisement for unsecured, renewable, non-supported notes at 11%. Well, hey, how could you lose money on that?
Well, and you, some artists, and I apologize, I can't read some of the names, but
yeah.
One of the artists perfectly captures deregulation in a cartoon that has no dialogue at all, just a man walking by a window which reads, First National Bank and Grill.
Grill. Hey, well, look, there's always going to be a market for burgers.
But, you know, you are at Ground Zero, as you said, even if, you know, some Wall Street people had, you know, had absolutely no idea that they aren't Main Street and they're hurting people, you know, on Main Street. It is Ground Zero. People are losing their jobs, foundations losing their fundings. You know, I think I already know the answer to this question, but did you have any hesitation?
People always ask when humor goes too far. And I guess sometimes it does, but you'll never find out unless you try. I mean, I think humor actually performs a very, very good function here. It does expose, you know, hypocrisy and cant. It does show you really what's going on at a visceral level. And on the other level, it also, since everybody is very stressed out, frankly, laughing is the opposite of stress. Yeah. And we sort of need this perspective that, you know, it's not the end of the world, and until it actually is, I think we should have a few laughs. Now, I think Dispatch hits it really right on the nose. I mean, it's about finance. It's not about people being killed. It's right now about people losing money and about being scared. So I think we really hit the right tone here.
Well, it reminds us, though, of other times when the magazine was questioned, maybe going too far. There was the July cover with the Obamas depicted as radicals, you know, fist bumping in the Oval Office. And the post 9/11 cover, now I know I'm talking about cover as opposed to cartoon. One of the funniest, I mean, it was the New Yorker stand cover.
The New Yorker stand cover. That cover was so wonderful, really, because it poked fun at ourselves.
Right.
I think that's the best type of humor. I think the easiest type of humor is sort of, you know, poking some fun at other people. I mean, a lot of humor is the humor of self-satisfaction. I'm great, and the other guy's a jerk. And I think a lot of our humor is the humor of self-dissatisfaction, where we really look at ourselves.
Well, and just for those who hadn't seen the New Yorker stand cover, my favorite was Central Parkistan and Forget Aboutistan. It was just a terrific issue.
And just wonderful in that the way New York might be envisioned from the other side of the world or vice versa.
Oh, we want to mention that the New Yorker has just endorsed Barack Obama. Does this mean that we're going to see a slew of cartoons making fun of that?
Making fun of our endorsement?
Yeah.
I think that would be a little bit too meta, making fun of the cartoons. I think our cartoons are best when they make fun of the political system. So it might be a politician, you know, saying something like, thank you very much for that pre-screened question, but before I give you my carefully rehearsed answer, let me disarm everyone with a canned joke. I certainly hope that if Obama gets elected, we will find many, many ways to make fun of him when he deserves it.
Bob Mankoff, cartoon editor for The New Yorker magazine, and we should say, famous in his own right for the cartoon of the clearly busy executive on the phone saying, no, Thursday's out. How's never? Is never good for you?
Really? I did that? Wow. You're the first person to ever mention that, but thanks.
Again, his editor of the complete cartoons of The New Yorker and also the New Yorker Cartoon Caption Contest book. Bob, thanks so much.
Okay, it was really a pleasure.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, despite all the turmoil in the economy, Halloween spending is expected to increase this year. The National Retail Federation says it might reach $5.77 billion. Well, if you have a bit of spare cash in your pocket and you're in Boston this weekend, consider shopping for a Halloween costume at the headquarters of the Boston Ballet, where they've once again cleaned out the closets with a costume shop sale. Here Now's Lynn Manigan found quite a few bargains and some interesting people when she visited in 2005.
Should we do $10?
This. Have some fun right before Halloween. Get some fun stuff from the ballet. Own a piece of ballet history. You know? I'm Heather McLernan. I'm one of the wardrobe supervisors for the Boston Ballet.
Any really, really good deals here?
I love the bumblebees. I'm actually thinking about buying a bumblebee myself. They're just so cute. They're $5. You get pants, you get a little headpiece, and you get a set of wings. You wear a black turtleneck, and you're perfect for Halloween. It's great.
You're one of the takers of the fuzzy bumblebee pants.
Yes.
Why?
Well, we're having a Halloween contest at work, and I have nothing, and I have till Monday to figure out, and here it is, $5, so why not?
Why not show up as a bumblebee?
Exactly.
Now, why not show up as a ballerina in a tutu?
Been there, done that.
And tutu is shows too much leg.
Yeah, probably for the work environment, yeah.
This will be perfect.
I didn't get your name.
Diane.
You never know when you might need a sparkly leotard.
Yeah, I'm Jeff Heyer.
Are you a ballet dad?
I am a ballet dad.
How many daughters do you have?
Two daughters who dance here all the time.
What are you looking for today?
Well, our daughters have seen most of these productions. They've admired most of the dancers who've done this, and this is an opportunity for them to feel more a part of it.
Get ready.
Yeah.
Right.
So I just got
this. $5 for the lovely bee costume. Big furry pants to keep you warm because it's snowing outside already.
Go to Sunday outfit, don't you? You know?
Sunday brunch.
Sunday brunch.
A bee brunch. Yeah. My name's Charles Haichu, and I run the costume department.
For how long?
This is my 8th season.
Almost everyone's
bought a bee, which is excellent.
Almost everyone's bought a bee? Why? Now, where are the bee costumes from?
They are from a production called Beehive, which was done, I believe, in the late 80s. And every once in a while we sell one off because people remember them, but it was time to sort of bring them all out and see what we could do.
Well, they're going.
They're going quickly.
Was this a good ballet?
I don't know. I never saw it.
It was all black and yellow?
Was, mostly black and yellow. There's a cactus that got pollinated on stage.
Is this cash only?
Cash only.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah. You could pay more money.
Okay.
Hello, do you mind if I speak with you?
No, go ahead.
You are shopping for a cactus and bumblebee pants while wearing an orange fright wig.
Yeah, that's right.
You are a man who is not afraid to be bold.
Well, that's right. I have two girls, Audrey and Lulu, and they just love to dress up, so I'm all up for finding some nice costumes.
Wonderful. Is this for Halloween for you, too?
Well, actually, I found a bee costume for myself, but this dress-up stuff is for my girls.
Are you going to wear the wig at any point?
No, but I thought I can't pass it up for $2, and I will find a time eventually to use it.
And you're about 6 feet tall. With the wig on, you're quite commanding.
Yeah.
I didn't get your name.
Gert.
You've got one of the nicest tutus.
These have a lot of history in them. These were made at the Royal Ballet in 1965, all of these Sleeping Beauty tutus.
And these costumes for sale here today are?
They're actually just from either really old productions that we've remade costumes, like the Sleeping Beauty tutus and the Woodland Nymph skirts, and then productions that we won't ever do again. And I know that we won't do them, so I can actually sell off the pieces.
That would be the bumblebee.
The bumblebees, for instance. I don't think that we'll ever do it again. I might be surprised one day, but I'll deal with it then. Enjoy the bee.
Our visit to the 2005 Boston Ballet Costume Sale was brought to us by Here Now's Lynn Manigan. Again, this year's is tomorrow. Still to come, your letters here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
We're back, and we want to take a few minutes for your thoughts, starting with an inelegant moment this week. Now, we pride ourselves on doing a lot of live as opposed to pre-taped coverage of wild news weeks like this one, but occasionally that makes for a bumpy ride. For instance, this moment with University of Maryland economist Peter Morici.
Well, I was just giving you credit for working under the during the Clinton administration,
well,
yet
really
being critical.
I really don't want partisan credit from you, and I don't want to be identified with the Democratic
Party.
Well,
we forged on, but not before losing Jessica Dolley of Birmingham, Alabama, who wrote, "I expect more civility from a public radio guest." On the other hand, Jonathan Spencer of Boston stayed and wrote, "I appreciated Peter Morici's emotion. I'd love to have him as a professor." And Randall Newcomb wrote to us, "I wondered where you'd take the discussion, and instead of taking it as a personal affront, invoking host privileges, whatever those might be, you did this neat jujitsu maneuver, suggesting the real story might be in the commentator's rage."
But also what I'm hearing from you is that your hair is on fire and you are very angry. And I want to.
Randall writes, "That turned it into a far more interesting exploration. Thank you." Well, thank you. We also spoke this week with Bruce Marks, CEO of the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, the advocacy group that helps homeowners with skyrocketing variable interest rates negotiate more affordable fixed mortgages. That prompted this call from Paul Golder.
"Basically, it's the right idea, but there's one problem. In order for a loan to be rescheduled and made a fixed-rate mortgage, you still have to have the mortgage in-house. What happened is the bank sold it. It got packaged into these bond-like securities, and I think now they're not able to reschedule it."
Well, we've called Bruce Marks up to ask him, how do you negotiate to restructure your mortgage? Now, Bruce, we understand all mortgages are sold, but in two ways. One, they can be cut up and sold to investors, or two, they're wholly owned by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the private companies recently taken over by the government. So let's say it's the first case. Your loan has been cut up and sold. How do you renegotiate it?
Actually, Robin, that's very easy to deal with because the servicers, the entities that you send your mortgage payment to every month, they have a contract with the investors that says if there's a risk of default, these servicers can do whatever is necessary to prevent that default. And we've been able to get over 10,000 mortgages restructured because these servicers have the authority to do that.
And sometimes you even talk directly to the investors.
That is right. They have to give us the name and the ability to appeal it to the investors.
But what about if you find out your loan is owned wholly by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Right. That's where the problem is. They're the ones who are the most resistant to the restructuring of the loans. It's an outrage.
And lastly, E. Lyon caught my bad. I said Icarus was written by Paul Winter. No, it was written by Ralph Towner, a member of the Paul Winter Consort and later the group Oregon. A great excuse to hear a little again. Send us your thoughts at letters@here-now.org. Well, two green, scaly lizards will slither on stage in Boston tonight as part of a new, reconstituted production of Edward Albee's play Seascape. For its 1975 Broadway premiere, Albee had to cut some scenes. But now, for the first time, American audiences can see Seascape as it was originally written. Well, we set Here and Now's Andrea Shea to find out how the owner of a small Boston theater got permission to dive into Seascape's missing scenes. He told her it wasn't all that difficult.
In the simplest of terms, I asked.
That's Zeitgeist stage director David Miller. He's a self-professed Edward Albee groupie. The playwright's cutting-edge dialogue and fearless take on marriage grabbed Miller decades ago.
When I was 13, I saw Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on TV, and I was just mesmerized by it.
He still is. Now in his 40s, Miller directs edgy plays and also owns Encore, a theater-themed bed and breakfast. He named an upstairs room after his idol.
This is the alcove, and it features a poster from the New York production of Three Tall Women, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama.
As it turns out, Albee himself slept here in the Albee room a few years ago. From that visit, Miller obtained the playwright's email address. Miller remembered reading about the three-act version of Seascape, so he asked Albee for permission to stage the play with the missing underwater scenes. The request inspired Albee to revisit the original script.
And I discovered I liked it just as much as the two-act version, maybe even more. And I certainly wanted to see it on its feet.
An apt choice of words, because Seascape is about evolution. Thinking back on the play's evolution, Albee says he excised the underwater scenes for the Broadway premiere because his producers said the sets would be too complicated and too costly. The ending was perhaps too much of a downer. Albee changed that too. Now, the 80-year-old playwright is thrilled to see the seminal version of Seascape.
I wrote this three-act play where two human beings are sitting on the beach in Cape Cod, probably, and they are confronted by two giant lizards who happen to speak English.
Were lizards in the process of evolution rather than just plain lizards?
Actress Emma Goodman plays the lizard named Sarah in the new Seascape.
So when we first get on stage, we are seeing the humans, and they see us, and they're terrified because, well, we're human-sized lizards.
Stay here, Nancy.
Charlie, what are they?
Stay back here. Get me a stick.
Charlie, what are they?
Get me a stick.
What?
A stick.
In the two-act version, the lizards begin to talk on the beach, human turf. In the rehydrated three-act script, the lizards take the anxious humans, Charlie and Nancy, underwater to their world.
Nancy! We're gonna die!
Once below, the humans warm up to the environment and soon to their scaly captors.
If you're going to kill us and eat us, then we're unfriendly. We will resist.
Well, I certainly don't believe we're planning to do that. Were we?
Well, no. What? I don't think so.
Of course not. The very idea.
After all.
Let's introduce ourselves, Charlie.
You're rather large. Quite unusual. Were you thinking of eating us?
Oh, heavens, no!
Well, we don't know your habits.
Well,
Stop.
I'm Nancy, and this is Charlie.
How do?
Claude Dell plays Leslie the Lizard, Sarah's feisty mate.
I'm definitely in awe. I'm not believing what they're saying. It seems like they're pulling my leg, so to speak. But there are other times when there are similarities I find between the lizards and the humans.
And that's the point of the play, that humans aren't that many steps out of the evolutionary muck. To create the surreal underwater world, lighting designer Jeff Adelberg says he opted to saturate the stage and the actors simply in deep blues and greens.
It doesn't need to be anything complicated, you know? I mean, we're obviously not quite there yet. You've seen it, it's still a little rocky. The transition isn't totally graceful yet, but I think we can do it.
Director David Miller designed the set, carting in 4.5 tons of sand for the beach, which also serves as the ocean floor. He says Albee's Broadway producers might have been daunted by the underwater scenes because they often lean towards Disney-esque.
Creating a realistic underwater atmosphere could be very costly, you know, and then you get into, okay, are the humans on wires? How do you do that suspended floating thing?
And how do you get the audience members to suspend their disbelief?
You just ask the audience to go along with you and use their imagination, and for me, that's what theater is about.
Edward Albee agrees. He has faith in the Zeitgeist production and the play itself. He muses, though, about the fact that the two-act version that ran on Broadway 33 years ago won a Pulitzer Prize.
When the three-act version comes out, if people see that, I wonder if they'll take the prize away from me. You never know.
Edward Albee says he plans to come to Boston to see the wet version of Seascape later this month.
Here and Now's Andrea Shea. To see photos and video from a rehearsal of Seascape, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.